The following episode contains mature content. Parental discretion is advised for any listeners under the age of 18.
Sunday, 9:01 p.m.
Hey, podcast angels. I was walking along kind of a cold river path the other day listening to James Baldwin and felt like, yeah, we can do good things as humans. And it's okay, even though we suck sometimes. So I wanted to thank you for that, and also for stories with meth and dildos in them, because it's all part of the same thing. Thank you, Paris Review Podcast, for making my life better.
And then we'll just keep on talking.
The Paris Review Podcast, Episode 10, The Occasional Dream. Featuring fiction by Joy Williams, read by Mary Louise Parker.
We can't disown the light into which we're born.
An archival recording of John Ashbery, reading his poem Soonest Mended.
To step free at last, minuscule on the gigantic plateau.
A poem by Roberto Bolaño, read by Dakota Johnson.
It's nothing serious, but it's the best way to get you out of my life.
And we begin with a poem by Frank O'Hara, read by David Sedaris.
A True Account of Talking to the Sun at Fire Island by Frank O'Hara. The sun woke me this morning loud and clear, saying, "Hey, I've been trying to wake you up for 15 minutes. Don't be so rude. You were only the second poet I've ever chosen to speak to personally. So why aren't you more attentive? If I could burn you through the window, I would to wake you up. I can't hang around here all day." "Sorry, son. I stayed up late last night talking to Hal. When I woke up Mayakovsky, he was a lot more prompt," the son said, petulantly. "Most people are up already, waiting to see if I'm going to put in an appearance." I tried to apologize. "I missed you yesterday." "That's better," he said. "I didn't know you'd come out. You may be wondering why I've come so close." "Yes," I said, beginning to feel hot, wondering if maybe he wasn't burning me anyway. "Frankly, I wanted to tell you, I like your poetry. I see a lot on my rounds, and you're okay. You may not be the greatest thing on earth, but you're different. Now, I've heard some say you're crazy. They being excessively calm themselves, to my mind, and other crazy poets think you're a boring reactionary. Not me. Just keep on like I do and pay no attention. You'll find that people always will complain about the atmosphere, either too hot or too cold, too bright or too dark, days too short or too long. If you don't appear at all one day, they think you're lazy or dead. Just keep right on. I like it. And don't worry about your lineage, poetic or natural. The sun shines on the jungle, you know, on the tundra, the sea, the ghetto. Whatever you were, I knew it and saw you moving. I was waiting for you to get to work. And now that you are making your own days, so to speak, even if no one reads you but me, you won't be depressed. Not everyone can look up, even at me. It hurts their eyes. Oh, son, I'm so grateful to you. Thanks, and remember, I'm watching. It's easier for me to speak to you out here. I don't have to slide down between buildings to get your ear. I know you love Manhattan, but you ought to look up more often. And always embrace things. People, earth, sky, stars, as I do, freely and with the appropriate sense of space. That is your inclination, known in the heavens, and you should follow it to hell if necessary, which I doubt. Maybe we'll speak again in Africa, of which I too am especially fond. Go back to sleep now, Frank, and I may leave a tiny poem in that brain of yours as a farewell. Son, don't go. I was awake at last. No, go I must. They're calling me. Who are they? Rising, he said, someday you'll know. They're calling to you, too. Darkly, he rose, and then I slept.
When Lisa Told Me, by Roberto Bolaño. When Lisa told me she'd made love to someone else, in that old Tepeyac warehouse phone booth, I thought my world was over. A tall, skinny guy with long hair and a long cock, who didn't wait more than one date to penetrate her deep.
It's nothing serious,
she said.
But it's the best way to get you out of my life.
Parmenides Garcia Saldana had long hair and could have been Lisa's lover, but some years later I found out he'd died in a psych ward or killed himself. Lisa didn't want to sleep with losers anymore. Sometimes I dream of her and see her happy and cold in a Mexico drawn by Lovecraft.
We listen to music.
Canned Heat, one of Parmenides Garcia Saldana's favorite bands.
And then we made love three times. First, he came inside me, then he came in my mouth, and the third time, barely a thread of water, a short fishing line between my breasts. And all in 2 hours,
said Lisa. The worst 2 hours of my life, I said from the other end of the phone.
The Paris Review's Southern editor, John Jeremiah Sullivan, singing From Four Till Late, a song written by Robert Johnson. After this quick break, Making Friends, a short story by Joy Williams, read by Mary Louise Parker. This is the Paris Review podcast from the Paris Review and Stitcher.
And when I come back again, I'll have a great long story to tell.
Making Friends, a story by Joy Williams. Willie and Liberty broke into a house on Crab Key and lived there for a week. Crab Key was tiny and exclusive, belonging to an association which had armed security patrol. The houses on Crab Key were owned by people so wealthy that they were hardly ever there. They were elsewhere. Liberty and Willie saw the guard daily. He was an old, lonely man, rather glossy and puffed up. His jaw puckered in and his chest puffed out like a child concentrating on making a muscle. He told Willie he had a cancer, but that grapefruit was curing it. Willie and Liberty must have reminded him of people he knew, people who must have looked appropriate living in a $300,000 cypress villa on the beach. He thought they were guests of the owners. Willie did have a look to him. People would babble on to Willie as though in his implacability they would find their grace. Liberty couldn't understand it herself. Willie's detail was gone. He had a closed, sleek face which did not transmit impressions. He was tight as a jar of jam. People were crazy about Willie.
If I were young, I wouldn't be here, the guard said. The big show is definitely not way out here.
The big show is in our heads, Willie said. Willie and the guard got on famously. In the house, Clem was lying before the sliding glass doors, his breath making small parachuting soles on the glass. Clem was Liberty's dog, a big white Alsatian with one blind eye. His good eye was open, watching his vacation.
The guard said, "You know, I'll tell you, my name is Turnip Seed."
"Glad to know you," Willie said.
"That name mean nothing to you?"
"I don't believe it does," Willie said. The guard shook his head back and forth, back and forth.
"How quickly they forget," he said to an imaginary person on his right. Liberty said nothing. She supposed they were about to be arrested. She and Willie were young, but they had been breaking into other people's houses for many years now. They were bound to get arrested someday.
"My nephew, Donald Jean Turnipseed, killed Jimmy Dean. You know, his car ran into Jimmy Dean's car."
"Well," Willie said, "1955.
"Seems like a long time ago, but I don't see what difference that makes," Turnipseed said. "We are talking about something immortal here. Young girls have made a cult of Dean, even though he was a faggot."
"Life is not a masterpiece," Willie agreed.
"Life's a damn mess," the guard said. He seemed genuinely outraged. Turnipseed enjoyed cooking. In inclement weather, he could be seen sitting in his patrol car reading cookbooks. He loved reading cookbooks. He and Willie would speak with fervor about chili and cassoulets and pineapple glazed yams and pastry sucre.
"Your wife looks sad," Turnipseed said to Willie. "She had a loss recently."
"She's just one of those wives," Willie said.
"What do women want? Let me ask you that," Turnipseed said. "My last two wives always maintained they were miserable, even though they had every distraction and convenience. Number two had a four-wheel drive vehicle with a personalized license plate. Every week she'd have her hair done. She died of a stroke at the beauty shop under the dryer.
Liberty isn't distracted easily, Willie said.
What would our lives be without our distractions? Turnipseed said. That's the question.
The house that Liberty and Willie had taken as their own was simple and soaring, but it was cluttered within. The owners seemed to possess everything in triplicate except for reading material. The only thing to read was a newspaper 7 weeks old. Liberty kept glancing at it. There were two items of considerable interest, she thought. One was an article about trees. It said that each person in the world needs all the oxygen produced in a year by a tree with 30,000 leaves. The other item was about babies. A nurse had made the first error. She had mixed up two newborn babies and given them to the wrong mother for nursing. A second nurse, on a different shift, switched them back again. The first nurse, realizing her initial error, switched them a third time, switched the little plastic bracelets on their chubby wrists, switched the coated scribbled plastic inserts on their rolling baskets. At this point, the situation had become hopelessly scrambled. 3 days passed. The mothers went home with the wrong babies. This was not a Prince and Pauper type story. Both mothers had nice homes and fathers and siblings for the baby. 4 months later, the hospital called and told the mothers that they had the wrong babies. They had proof, toe prints and blood types, chemical proof. They had done the things professionals do to prove that a person is the person he is supposed to be. The mothers were hysterical. They had fallen in love with the wrong baby, and now they didn't want to give their wrong baby up. But apparently, it had to be done. It seemed to be the law. Breaking into houses caused Liberty to become pensive. She would get cramps and lose her appetite. Stolen houses made her think of babies all the time. She supposed that was common enough. The house on Crab Key had chocolate-colored wall-to-wall carpeting scattered with oriental rugs. It had a Mexican-tiled tub that could accommodate four. The Italian chrome and mica kitchen contained every mechanized friend known to the cook, and the cupboards were filled with canned goods. There was a closet off the bath which contained nothing but toilet paper. "This is how the elderly prepare for nuclear attack," Willie said, staring in at the treasury of white two-ply. Willie loved living in other people's houses and sleeping in their beds. He wore their clothes and drank their liquor and saw himself in their mirrors. He got a very satisfying hit from breaking into houses and living an ordered life. In this particular house, there was a large walk-in closet. There were mirrors and cosmetics. There were shoe boxes and garment bags. There were hats and ties. Everything was neatly categorized. Cruise wear, ethnic shawls and dresses, Daddy's World War I uniforms. As in the other homes Liberty and Willie tended to occupy, the absent owners were organized, hopeful, acquisitive, and fearful of death. It was astonishing to Liberty that all this was being guarded by Turnipseed, a man obsessed with walks, dead wives, and movie stars, and armed with a floating flashlight and a tire iron. He was obviously not in the best of health. His eyes were like breakfast buns spread with guava jelly. To Liberty, he said, "That certainly is the strangest white dog I've ever seen. Nothing unfortunate is about to happen to you, not if that dog can help it." "I don't know," Liberty said.
Well, thank God it ain't a black dog. Black dogs are bad luck.
Thank God, Liberty said.
The thought of a black dog, black as dirt and filled with blood, she would never have a black dog.
Liberty and Turnipseed gazed at one another. Liberty and Turnipseed just couldn't seem to build up a dialogue.
Where'd you get that dog? Turnipseed asked, cranking up again, his voice hoarse.
Found him, Liberty said.
I've never found a thing myself, Turnipseed said. I try not to dwell on it.
He gazed at Clem, not knowing how to salute him. Turnipseed lived on the mainland in a little cement block house on a land sucked senseless by the phosphate interests.
I've had 3 wives, and each one of them died, Turnipseed confided. Isn't that a ghastly coincidence?
In continuity, there is a little of everything and everything else, Willie said when Liberty just couldn't seem to pick anything out of the air. Willie and the guard seemed to have a way of conversing that was satisfying to them both. Willie enjoyed a simple deceit more than just about anything in the world, Liberty guessed. Nobody at all seemed to grasp what she and Willie were doing. Liberty began to feel unreal. The words Willie exchanged with Turnipseed rocked gently in her head, unwholesome crafts on a becalmed sea. Nonetheless, the days passed. In the mornings, Liberty trudged along with Clem on the wide, shelly beach. There she met women who searched for shark's teeth. These women had elaborate tooth scoopers made of screening and wood. They had spotting scoops and dip boxes. They were dedicated and purposeful, and hustling in and out of the surf, they knew what they were about. Liberty admired them. They knew the difference between a spinner's tooth and a lemon's. They were happy women, rigorous in their selections. In their bags, they had duskies and black tips and Mako's teeth. They loved those teeth. In their homes, lamplight glowed from wired glass bases filled with teeth. The women who searched the beaches put their finest teeth on velvet and framed them behind glass. The more common teeth spelled out homilies or were arranged in the shape of hearts. These women on the beach knew what was necessary to them. None of them spoke to Liberty. They regarded Clem with downright unease, as though fearing he would squat on their fossiliferous wash-ins. Liberty felt that the women were correct in not introducing themselves and being friendly. She, Liberty, was a thief and a depressive. She'd been married by a drunken judge at Monroe Station in the Everglades. The bridal couple had eaten their wedding supper in a restaurant which had antique rifles and dried chicken feet mounted on the wall. Their wedding supper had consisted of a gigantic snook that Willie had miraculously caught on a dough ball and cake that the cook had whipped up special. They'd gotten drunk and ended up throwing pieces of cake at each other. Those women probably saw Liberty's problems just written all over her. As for Clem, they avoided him like shoppers swerving from a swollen can of bouillabaisse. When the mornings departed, leaving the afternoons, Liberty went back to the house and took a nap, dreaming of the things she did in stolen houses. Churches and flowers and suitcases, bowls and water and caves. Usually when she woke up, Willie was taking a picture of her. He had found a camera in the house and half a dozen rolls of film. The owners were prepared for anything. They were prepared to shoot the end. Willie took shots of Liberty eating from a can of peaches. He took shots of her in her mildewy bikini. He took shots of her with a sea oat between her teeth and an aspirin in her hand. Liberty saw that her life was being recorded in some way. Nevertheless, she was aware that her moments lacked incident. Willie took pictures of Turnipseed as well. Turnipseed was tired.
He was tired of the responsibility. "Looking back on it," he said, "if I had to do it all over again, I just don't know if I could." Willie said, "We can't disown the light into which we're born." In the hot, simple, uncaring light, Turnipseed gave a smile rather like a little baby's. "You got a lot of my first wife in you, son. What a sweetie she was. Number one was the one I really boogied with, if you know what I mean. She said that being sad separates a person from God."
"She said that?"
Willie wondered. "I believe she used those very words," Turnipseed said. Willie put the rolls of film in an antique brass bowl on the floor in the middle of the living room. Liberty took them outside at noon and broke the film from the cassettes. She would give the strips to Yvonne, a child she knew. Yvonne would undoubtedly use the film in a creative manner. She might attach the coils to her headband and pretend she was a princess from the planet Eitner. The sheets of film would be her face. Things had uses for which they were not intended, certainly. That's what made a person keep getting up in the morning. That was their last day in the house. They saw Turnipseed staggering along the beach with an enormous Glad bag filled with empty beer cans. "There's enough aluminum on the beaches of Florida to build an airplane," Turnipseed said. "We've got to be off now," Willie said. "We're leaving." "Leaving this radiant place," Turnipseed said. "Well, I don't blame you." "Last night, you know, in town, I just could swear I saw my middle wife in the laundromat. She didn't speak to me." "Well," Willie said, "the dead can't disappear. After all, where would they go?" "I like your manner, son," Turnipseed said. "I'm going to miss you. Take care of that wife of yours. She seems to be living in a world where this don't follow that, if you know what I mean." Later, when the Crab Key Association discovered that Turnipseed had been on such excellent terms with the besmirchers, an aneurysm would smack into Turnipseed's heart with the grace of a speeding Cadillac kissing a box turtle. Liberty could still see him waving goodbye.
Still ahead, an archival recording of John Ashbery reading his poem, Soonest Mended, featuring original scoring by musician Steve Gunn. This is the Paris Review podcast from the Paris Review and Stitcher.
By that time, we were in another chapter and confused about how to receive this latest piece of information. Was it information?
Welcome to New Letters on the Air. I'm Rebecca Presson, bringing you a reading by one of our most acclaimed poets, John Ashbery. John Ashbery set out to be a painter and has said he uses words abstractly, as an abstract painter uses paint. This abstraction occasionally drives critics to distraction and even to the charge that the poet's work is unintelligible. However, X.J. Kennedy says, quote, "If the reader can shut off that portion of his brain which insists words be related logically, he may dive with pleasure into Ashbery's stream of consciousness. There, words often appear in unexpectedly brilliant new combinations," end quote.
I was the class poet when I graduated from college, and I wasn't able to produce a class poem. So what I did was to take a poem that I had already written that sounded kind of ominous, and I read that, and that seemed to go over okay. Since then, I've written a lot more ominous poetry. This one was written about 15 years ago, I believe, and it's called Soonest Mended, as in the phrase least said, soonest mended. I should explain a couple of obscure references in it. One is to, well, Orlando Furioso is not an obscure reference, but there's a painting which you possibly know of a scene from it by Anger, which is referred to. Also, a forgotten comic strip called Happy Hooligan, about a funny hobo who wore a tin can hat. You may be wondering what these things have to do with each other, and you may not know when I've finished. Anyway, here goes. Barely tolerated, living on the margin in our technological society, we were always having to be rescued on the brink of destruction, like heroines in Orlando Furioso, before it was time to start all over again. There would be thunder in the bushes, a rustling of coils, and Angelica in the Angra painting was considering the colorful but small monster near her toe, as though wondering whether forgetting the whole thing might not in the end be the only solution. And then there always came a time when Happy Hooligan in his rusted green automobile came plowing down the course just to make sure everything was okay. Only by that time, we were in another chapter and confused about how to receive this latest piece of information. Was it information? Weren't we rather acting this out for someone else's benefit? Thoughts in a mind with room enough and to spare for our little problems, so they began to seem. Our daily quandary about food and the rent and bills to be paid. To reduce all this to a small variant, to step free at last, minuscule on the gigantic plateau, this was our ambition, to be small and clear and free. Alas, the summer's energy wanes quickly, a moment and it is gone. And no longer may we make the necessary arrangements, simple as they are. Our star was brighter, perhaps, when it had water in it. Now there is no question even of that, but only of holding on to the hard earth so as not to get thrown off with an occasional dream, a vision. A robin flies across the upper corner of the window. You brush your hair away and cannot quite see. Or a wound will flash against the sweet faces of the others. Something like, this is what you wanted to hear, so why did you think of listening to something else? We are all talkers, it is true, but underneath the talk lies the moving and not wanting to be moved, the loose meaning, untidy and simple like a threshing floor. These then were some hazards of the course, yet though we knew the course was hazards and nothing else, it was still a shock when almost a quarter of a century later, the clarity of the rules dawned on you for the first time. They were the players, and we who had struggled at the game were merely spectators, though subject to its vicissitudes and moving with it out of the tearful stadium, borne on shoulders at last. Night after night, this message returns, repeated in the flickering bulbs of the sky, raised past us, taken away from us, yet ours over and over until the end that is past truth, the being of our sentences, in the climate that fostered them, not ours to own like a book, but to be with, and sometimes to be without, alone and desperate. But the fantasy makes it ours, a kind of fence sitting raised to the level of an aesthetic ideal. These were moments, years, solid with reality, faces, nameable events, kisses, heroic acts, but like the friendly beginning of a geometrical progression, not too reassuring, as though meaning could be cast aside someday when it had been outgrown. Better, you said, to stay cowering like this in the early lessons, since the promise of learning is a delusion. And I agreed, adding that tomorrow would alter the sense of what had already been learned, that the learning process is extended in this way, so that from this standpoint, none of us ever graduates from college. For time is an emulsion, and probably thinking not to grow up is the brightest kind of maturity for us, right now at any rate. And you see, both of us were right, though nothing has somehow come to nothing. The avatars of our conforming to the rules and living around the home have made, well, in a sense, good citizens of us, brushing the teeth and all that, and learning to accept the charity of the hard moments as they are doled out. For this is action, this not being sure, this careless preparing, sowing the seeds crooked in the furrow, making ready to forget, and always coming back to the mooring of starting out that day so long ago. Thank you.
Concludes the Paris Review Podcast, Episode 10, The Occasional Dream. The pieces that you heard in this episode are A True Account of Talking to the Sun at Fire Island by Frank O'Hara. It appeared in the Paris Review, Issue 45, Winter, 1968, and is part of the collected poems of Frank O'Hara. The poem was read by
David Sedaris.
Special thanks to Knopf and to Maureen Granville Smith, administratrix of the estate of Frank O'Hara. When Lisa Told Me by Roberto Bolaño. The poem appeared in the Paris Review, Issue 201, Summer 2012. It was read by
Dakota Johnson.
Making Friends by Joy Williams, which appeared in the Paris Review, Issue 82, Winter 1981. It was read by
Mary Louise Parker.
The Paris Review will honor Joy Williams with the 2018 Haddada Award for Lifetime Achievement at our annual gala, The Spring Revel. Soonest Mended, written and read by John Ashbery. It appeared in the Paris Review, Issue 47, Summer 1969, and in Ashbery's book, The Double Dream of Spring. The 1986 recording of John Ashbery is from the archives of the public radio program New Letters on the Air, broadcasting nationally since 1977 from the University of Missouri, Kansas City. To hear the full Ashbery program and programs featuring other great writers, visit their website at newletters.org. The excerpt we used features an introduction from host Rebecca Presson, dulcimer music by Matt Kirby, and the New Letters theme song by Gerald Kemner. The scoring for the poem itself is a new composition, written and performed by guitarist Steve Gunn. His most recent album, Eyes on the Line, is available on Matador Records. Our thanks to the Morgan Library and Museum, home of the archive of the Paris Review. Also, thanks to Doug Gould, who recorded David Sedaris at Terra Note Records in Moorhead City, North Carolina. This podcast is a co-production of the Paris Review and Stitcher. Our executive producers are Chris Bannon, Brendan Francis Noonan, the Reverend John Delore, and me, Nicole Rudick. Our production team includes Lori Dorr, Caitlin Youngquist, Jeff Gleaves, and Matt Levin. Our advisory board members are Tony Ann Fernandez, Leanne Shapton, Igioma Ozoto, and Sadie Stein. This episode was mixed and sound designed by John Delore, featuring original music composed by David Sierra, who plays piano, organs, and waterphone. With Mike Brown on bass, Shahzad Ismaili and Sam Ospavad on drums, and Rob Schwimmer on the Hacken Continuum. Additional compositions and sequencing by Casey Holford. If you liked what you heard, be sure to subscribe to this podcast in Stitcher or Apple Podcasts. Don't forget to rate and review the show. As always, if you want to read any of the pieces in this episode, subscribe at theparisreview.org. You'll get access to our full digital archive and 4 print issues, featuring the very best in new poetry, fiction, and interviews, delivered straight to your door on good old-fashioned ink and paper. Thanks for listening.
I don't know how to read poetry.
Stitcher.
Here's a preview of what's coming up in the next episode of the Paris Review podcast.
Tis his motto, yesterday's weirdness is tomorrow's reason. HST, 714-78, was great.
Archival tape from George Plimpton and Terry McDonald's visit to Hunter S. Thompson's home, Owl Farm.
You can hear the fun, you can hear the music.
Yeah.
Plus, a poem from Pablo Neruda and Amy Baradil's short story, William Way. That's next time on the Paris Review podcast from the Paris Review and Stitcher.